This session is titled The Adventure of Evangelism, and that's sort of a churchy or institutional title for what we're going to talk about. I'm George Anderson, and I'm hoping today that we can deal with that kind of feeling you get when you have friends that you may go shopping with or hunting with or belong to a civic club with or play bridge with, and somewhere along the line religion comes up and they say something to you like, "Oh well, we've got too many other things to do and we just don't have time for that sort of thing. We're interested in stamp collecting or hunting or fishing or whatever it may be." And they give you permission to be interested in religion. That's your hobby, it seems, the way they see it. But they have their own things and they're interested in, and they'll drive right by your church on Sunday morning on their way to the lake or to the mountains or to the grandchildren or something else. And they seem to be so so busy and happy and this worldly, one can say, here and now kind of people, that they just seem to have no interest in what is an important element in your life. And the question is, what do you do then? Well, first of all, don't panic. I had an experience that taught me a lot about how one can look at your own faith and your religious commitment. I was an invoker at a meeting. Pastors are often asked to start off meetings. It's difficult otherwise sometimes for people to know when meetings get underway. If they have an invocation, it's a clear knot at the beginning of the thread that something's going to happen, and it quiets everybody down. So they will find a convenient pastor to invoke. So this allows me to be on the platform with all kinds of different things. Sonny and I, for a number of years, were invited to the South Carolina Wildlife Federation. We always thought that sounded very exciting, but it turns out that they mostly are interested in conserving the deer and the swamps and pelicans and other things in South Carolina. But when you go to these various meetings, they usually have a speaker. And I remember at one time, the speaker was a psychiatrist. This was not at the Wildlife Federation. That's something else which has escaped me. But he gave a very interesting talk. And at the end of the talk, we were all filing off of the platform. And it happened that he and I just were walking together toward the outside of the banquet hall. And this man came up, obviously agitated, and immediately confronted the good doctor, and he said, "Are you the fellow who talked on psychiatry?" The fellow said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I want you to know, I think that's just a bunch of baloney." Well, I sat there and I thought, gee, it's nice to be in the bleachers for once and not be the center of attack. I've heard people say similar things about religion, so let's just see how the good doctor handles this. Well, the doctor mumbled something about really, and the fellow went right on. "Yeah, I think you guys are just preying on everybody's ignorance. It's just like black magic, superstition. You make people think that they're sick in order to give yourself a good income, and then you just victimize these folks and use them for your own advantage. It's just a good way to make a lot of money." Well, I've heard some similar complaints about the clergy sometimes and about religion, so it'll be interesting to see how another discipline handles this matter. And I was very disappointed because the doctor just said, "Oh, I'm sorry you feel that way about it." And no fight, no quick repartee. He just kind of rolled over, played dead. And so the man, having exhausted now his fusillade against this whole discipline of psychiatry, felt he had made his point adequately. He turned on his heel and stalked off. But as soon as he left, the psychiatrist turned to me and he said, "You know, that man needs psychiatric help." And I thought to myself, right, this man is so confident in what he has to offer that he takes an attack not as some kind of personal defeat, but he sees it as a symptom of the very thing he has to offer. And I began to think about that and began to say, maybe the very parts of our culture that seem most negligent or anti-religion are exhibiting symptoms of a kind of hidden hunger, a kind of vitamin deficiency, which doesn't appear as a need for religion, but which in fact will not be satisfied by anything less than what the Christian gospel has to offer. Now let me just give you some examples. What might these kinds of deficiencies be? Scientists have done a lot of study on what humans need to be human, and once you get beyond the basic necessities, you come to things like a sense of freedom. People need to feel that the future is open, that what they do is meaningful and is not completely locked into some predetermined system. And yet people experience their lives very much as pretty well determined. They grow up in a particular neighborhood, they marry a particular person, they have a certain number of children who act in a certain way, the job demands a certain kind of routine, whether it's a 9-to-5 office routine or a 5-to-9 farm routine or whatever it might be, it's still a routine. And life begins to seem pretty cut and dried. Yet down deep, these people, they tell us, are hungry for freedom. Now, how would you experience freedom? I suppose you would experience it as novelty in your life, newness, new things. And I believe that that much of the, let's call it leisure activity that goes on in our country, much of the going to the lake and going to the ball game and even going fishing and sporting of all sorts are ways in which people try to recover a sense of novelty or newness in their life. Just take, for example, sports. The excitement about sports really is that you don't know how it's going to come out. And you're dedicated to a ball team or watch a ball game about which you know practically nothing, simply because you're interested in, you know, seeing the contest and who will win. And if you're like our family, you'll pick sides simply on the basis of the color of the jersey or how many in the family already have one side or another. And you can get excited and interested simply because there is something that is not predetermined. There's nothing we hate more than knowing that a game is fixed, for example, or, if you've ever been in the armed services, to get a rebroadcast of a game which you've already read the score in Stars and Stripes or something like that, where you know how the game came out and now they're rebroadcasting it. It's just not the same. Well, it seems to me that thirst for novelty is really built very deeply into us. At the time of the Korean War, there was much talk of brainwashing, you may remember. It was a new kind of technique, or at least a new word for something that had probably been going on for a long time in other forms. So there were a number of experiments done, and one was to ask volunteers to suspend themselves in a warm bath, a tepid bath of water, just body temperature, so that you got no sensation or feeling of heat or cold. And then to plug the orifices through which you normally receive sensations. You could hear nothing, you could see nothing. And you would just lie there in this warm bath, and what was happening was the experiment of sensory deprivation. You were not getting any new messages into your brain. And The surprising thing that happened was that when the brain is deprived of new information, of novelty, it begins to hallucinate. It seems that we are so dependent on new information and newness that when we can't get it from the outside, we manufacture it within. That's how hungry we are for novelty. And so we go fishing because we don't know how many we'll catch or how big they'll be. We go to sporting events. Some people gamble because they don't know how it's going to come out. This might be the big time to get away from the routine and to find some element of life that seems to be governed purely by chance, somehow feeds that part within us. Television, with its unending stream of images, is another way. Or, well, we were talking about fishing. You know the famous tale, I'm sure, about the Swede and the Norwegian who had been fishing, and the Norwegian comes back with a sack of fish, and the Swede says, "How many fish did you catch?" And the Norwegian says, "If you guess right, I'll give you both the fish." So the Swede guesses 3. The Norwegian says, "Ah, you dumb Swede, you missed it by 5. That goes on and on. Well, you laugh. Now, you see, laughing is a peculiarly human response to a surprise ending. We are delighted with jokes or stories by O. Henry because there is an element of novelty or newness in them. And we, among all creatures, have the ability to laugh, it seems, because we are somehow made for that kind of newness, surprise. We delight in surprises. Okay, so maybe we don't experience freedom directly, but we hunger for one of the signs of freedom, which is newness. And if we can't get our newness, our feeling of freedom elsewhere, then, like kids, we go out in search of what they call kicks. New experiences, something to give us the sense that the world isn't all takedown and predetermined. There's a marvelous story in the Old Testament, I'm sure you recall, the story of Jacob and Esau. Esau is the hunter, and he comes back without catching any food. And so he's terribly hungry, and he makes this very bad bargain. He exchanges his birthright for a bowl of lentil soup. And it seems to me that the people in our generation who are so busy with the leisure time industry or whatever it may be, are very similar to Esau. They are hungry for freedom or for novelty, I guess you could say. And so they sell their birthright of freedom and they settle for kicks. So that's one hunger they have. Another hunger is love. And when I say love now, I'm not talking about June, moon, croon, spoon sort of love. I'm talking about that feeling I am significant to some person, to someone. A woman named Dr. Alice Chase, who had written a book on nutrition for health and a number of other books on proper balanced diet, died in London about 3 or 4 years ago of malnutrition. And when they came to investigate how could a person who knew all about the right things to eat die of malnutrition, the answer was simply that she was old and alone, and she didn't care anymore. She felt she made no difference to anybody, so even the knowledge she had of how to eat properly no longer meant anything to her. This hunger for being important can have lots of symptoms. Sometimes taking a second job. We say it's for the kids or we say it's for the money. It may partly be for the status or the importance that it gives to us. Some pastors who say, I cannot take time off for continuing education, for example, because my congregation needs me so much, are perhaps really hungering and thirsting to be wanted and needed and feel that this is the only way it can happen. There are many, I think, people, women, for example, sometimes go to work to get a job, simply to get a feeling that they do mean something to somebody. They are important in the world, and they haven't found that satisfaction in their work in the home. And so they go out to be somebody or to get a recognition for their skill because they want to feel important. Teachers of children have discovered, as I guess you've read, that children will misbehave purposely just to get attention. That is, they will risk punishment. Punishment is better, is more acceptable to them than being ignored. So hungry are they for love that if they can't get love, they'll settle for attention. And so again, I think of Esau, who had a birthright of love, but he gave that up and settled instead, or his children settled for attention. And the people that are so busy, they say they don't have time for church because they're taking a second job, they've got to do this, that, or the other thing. They may be exhibiting that hunger for acknowledgement, of being recognized as somebody. And the way they express it is to try to take on another job or another chairmanship or keep busy. So that's another hunger. Third hunger, and this is the last one I want to mention. I'm sure there are lots more, but just to give you an example of the kind of dimensions of the situation, is a hunger for security. We worry a lot about people who today seem to have simply given up any conception of another world or anything beyond the here and now. We talk about here and now people. They're interested in this world and they don't much think about the next. Why is that? And what kind of hunger does that symbolize? Well, I think it's a symbol of a hunger for security, interestingly enough. I remember a trip I took on a Braniff airplane. Now, you're familiar with Braniff out in this part of the country, but I had never ridden on a Braniff plane before. And this was when they were starting their new paint the planes all kinds of colors and dress the waitry and various nice costumes and so on. And so I got on and discovered from my economy class seat that there was a clock on the bulkhead up in front of me. Well, now, Eastern Airlines would never dare to put a clock where any of their patrons could see it. But here was a clock, and it was one of those very nice laboratory sort of clocks. You know, it didn't even have numbers on it. It just had the notches, kind of, the black marks, and it was totally white-faced with the black marks and the black hands, and very severe and scientific-looking. And I checked my watch against it and got ready for the flight. And sure enough, just about on the minute, we took off, and I thought, I am in the hands now of technology that knows what's going on. Well, we got up in the air, and as they often do after a while, they pulled back the curtain between first and economy class, so you could look up there into the promised land, you know, and see what was going on and what they were eating or drinking. And I discovered that they had a clock, too, just like ours, no gold or anything on it, just as simple as ours. But their clock was 3 minutes faster than our clock. What? Suddenly my little world of security began to have great fissures in it, because I wonder which clock was correct. How do you determine? You start to rationalize, like, well, they're first class, they'll get there ahead of us. So. Or since they're first class, they're going to get everything 3 minutes before we do. And then, no, it doesn't work. And so which is correct? Was their clock better because it was the first class clock? No, I determined that I was going to live by my clock. This was my clock in economy class, and we're just going to forget about those people up there with theirs. As I thought about that reaction afterwards, I thought, isn't this typical that when data comes into our world that we can't quite deal with, if there is another world in which God is, in a sense, keeping a different kind of time and valuing things differently, how am I going to handle that? Well, the easiest way to handle it is to say, let's forget about first class. Let's just live here in economy class with our own clock and our own time in the here and now. In other words, if I make my world small enough, I can control it. And then that's a way of getting security. If I
deny death and dying, and if I call evil bad luck, and if I buy all risk insurance, which covers everything significantly but acts of God, I have, in a sense, protected my world. I've got it where I can handle it, and I can just forget about any other time system or any other data that may come in. It's the same way in terms of dealing with social problems. If I make my world small enough and cozy enough, then I can just forget about people who are questioning all the values and all the standards that I live by. And I suppose now that a lot of our here and now neighbors, a lot of the secularism, so to speak, that goes on, is not a secularism that arises out of confidence, but it is ultimately a secularism that arrives out of a desperate need for a world small enough to control. And so they make up their little world, and they give up their birthright of assurance and security, and settle instead for the mess of pottage we could call control. So the tragedy is, with all these folks, that they're still hungry. See? That the very symptoms of their fun-loving, busy, here-and-now lives demonstrate that down deep, they are desperately trying to fill a vacuum or a void. They are still hungry, but they are being fed with something that is not good old Holden bread. Not really whole grain and nourishing. So we have something to tell these people. If you think of our Christian message, it is really a message which addresses these kinds of needs. When you talk, for example, about, well, let's talk about assurance. It seems to me that to talk about God as Father is to say, as Jesus finally says when he's faced with the question of, will I maintain control of my life or will I hand it over to the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane? He chooses letting go, handing over, and leaving his life then in the hands of the Father, and thus receiving an assurance, a strength, which he never would have been able to obtain if he had tried to stay in control. And the resurrection, you see, is the demonstration that security, the security that goes beyond death, is there for those who understand what it means to say God is Father. God is creator both of this life and then of a life to come. Or, if you take the question of love, am I really important? Well, the whole message of Christ, it seems to me, is to say, yes, this is the... No, God cared enough to send the very best, as people have paraphrased the Hallmark ad. But it was that God did care enough, not just for the world in general, but Christ's message is so individualized in the sense of the talking about the sparrows, the lilies of the field, the 99 who are in the fold, the one who is gone after. Again and again, his message is the individual is also important. The flock, of course, is his, but there is this special concern, you as an individual are important. And so the sacraments are instituted to say, in baptism, I baptize you, John Edward, or Martha Lee, to make it personal, and then in the Lord's Supper, given and shed for you, as the elements are distributed. We break down the great sacraments of the church into the individual concern of God for the person. So God the Son is evidence, it seems to me, of this importance of the individual beyond what they do in life or how much they make or who their parents were. And then, of course, freedom, newness. We're talking about the Spirit in Bible study, morning session. It seems to me that the whole conception of the power and the gift of the Spirit is that things do not have to stay as they are. That, as Paul says in Galatians, the gifts of the Spirit are given to essentially help you fight against that which you normally would do. Things don't have to go on the way they are. You are not determined by your genes or your parents or your society. There is the possibility for conversion in one's life. And conversion is not then a hurdle that you have to overcome. It's the possibility of being different. That there is through God's Spirit, the possibility of renewal. And of course, then the Spirit, the very image, is used again and again of the wind that goes, you know, where it listeth. There's no way of trapping the Spirit of God. He moves where he will. And therefore, it's Paul again who speaks about the Spirit who gives us the perfect liberty of the children of God. So freedom and newness, that's there too. So when you confess Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you confess really security, love, and freedom also. You confess a God, in other words, who has care for and has the answer to these concerns that are perhaps expressed in a typically 20th century way, but are always there. Now the question comes, how do you get from knowing that people are feeling this way, knowing it better than they do, because they don't feel, you know, that I need church. They just feel this inner concern for the need of assurance or of security, love. How do you communicate that to them? Well, our evangelism programs have tended, it seems to me, to neglect this good news element. We talk about evangelism as good news a great deal. But the connection between the good news of Jesus and his love, if you want to take that famous hymn that we often sing, or the good news of the caring of the Father's heart, to use a phrase from Helmut Thielicke that Dr. Chilstrom quoted earlier, it seems to me to do that, we have to recognize that our typical evangelism approach tends to turn the good news into bad news almost immediately, because our motivation for much evangelism is better church attendance. And as soon as you make your motivation help our church, more people there, more people to contribute, more money to pay off the mortgage, for example, you are simply going to people with the same kind of thing that you go to people when you ask them to please buy a ticket to the fireman's ball or a raffle ticket or patronize the scout fair, whatever it is. You're going to them asking them to do you a favor. Come on and join our church. We need help to pay the mortgage. You know, we need more people in our church because it's not big enough or whatever. And so you go to people with that subconscious thought in mind. You are asking them to do you a favor to come. You don't think for a moment that you really have something to give them. You have a gift, something positive. Let's see just how it works out the other way. I've had lots of experience with that church attendance kind of thing. Because most people will say, well, I would like to be an evangelist, but I don't know enough. Let's have a class. Let's learn about how to be an evangelist. Well, a number of years ago in the LCA, we had a program that taught you how to be an evangelist. It was done with a chart. It was a turnover chart. And I happened to be a senior in seminary at the time, and one of the churches in Philadelphia where I was going to school wanted to have an evangelism program. So they hired me as their evangelist. And I said, I don't know much about evangelism. I'm only a seminary student, you know. And they said, oh, you ought to know all about it. But if you don't know, we have this chart. So I said, okay, I'll come and look at the chart. Well, it was a wonderful thing. You want to know, you know, how in the world do you make contact with people? You just go up and knock on the door. That was what I was supposed to do. What do you say? The chart said, say, how do you do? My name is George Anderson. I'm from Advent Lutheran Church. May I come in? And the chart assured me that in 99% of the cases, I would be admitted to the hall, which indeed was correct. Well, what do you say when you get inside? Suppose the television is on. This was in the early days of TV and people were still hypnotized by it. They said, when you come into a home, if the television is on, sit down next to the television. This was not so that you could compete with the program, but so that you would not start looking at the television and become totally hypnotized yourself and forget why you were there. Sit by the television, they said, and talk softly. So I go in and I sit down. I say, how do you do? I'm George Anderson. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it. And sure enough, somebody would say right away, go cut that thing off.
They meant the television, of course. It worked like a charm. You talk softly and they turn off the television. So then you had your audience. So then you would make a statement about, we'd like you to come to church. Well, the answer always was, we'd like to come, but. And then came a series of excuses. Well, the chart had all the excuses. And all you had to do was memorize the responses to those excuses. And it was just like checkers with an expert. They make this move, and you just sit back, and you move that way. Here was this wet behind the ears seminary student going into home after home, and within 20, 30 minutes, they would have exhausted their supply of excuses and be sitting there and would say something like, well, I guess we ought to come. When they said that, I would bring out the blue cards. I had two blue cards. They were identical. And I would ask them to sign this blue card, which said, it is my intention to attend Advent Lutheran Church next Sunday, and you put in the date, and they would sign it. One of these would be taken by me back to the greeters at the church, so that when these people then came, the greeters could know, oh yes, Mr. and Ms. So-and-so, glad to see you here. The other card, however, stayed and was either put up on the bathroom mirror or was set behind the sink up on, the counter, so that it would remind the people during the week that they had signed a pledge that they were going to come to church, just the way you'd sign a contract to buy a vacuum cleaner and encyclopedia. Once I had gotten the blue card signed, I had essentially done my work. I bade them farewell. I left and went on to the next door, knocked, made my entrance, talked softly, and pretty soon was distributing another blue card. It worked like a charm, and I must say that chart was really omniscient as far as knowing all the issues that could be raised. There was only one small problem with this process. About 3 weeks after I had started, and I worked every Saturday on this, the pastor came to me and he said, the greeters want to know what you're doing with those blue cards. I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you keep bringing back blue cards signed, but nobody ever comes. Are you signing them yourself and just turning them in at the end of the day? I said, no, these are honestly signed cards. The people finally agree that they ought to be in church, and they sign the cards, and I don't know why they don't come. Well, the chart said, what to do when people do not come? The answer was, call back. So, I took the cards, of which I had now a fairly good number, and I went back to those same addresses, and I knocked on the door, and there was a little more hesitation on letting me in this time, but I was once again admitted, and I sat down, and I talked softly, and sure enough, they had thought up several more excuses. And they said, I started always by saying, missed you in church. And they would say, really sorry we didn't make it, but, and then they would give a new excuse. Well, it was a replay of, round one. Except everything went quicker this time. They'd try one or two new excuses and then they'd give up. And they'd ask me for the blue card. Because they realized that I was really not in the evangelism business, I was in the blue card business. And if they signed a blue card, I would leave. There was no need to go through all this humiliation of having this seminary student out talking and out arguing. All they had to do was ask for a blue card, I would get them to sign it, and I would happily go out the door. And so, looking back on that experience, I recognize that I was not bringing those people one iota of good news. I was bringing them really bad news. By the time I left, their feelings probably were the following. Number one, how did that kid make us look so stupid? We are not that dumb. And why did he out-argue us on every point? Number two, boy, we really are guilty for not going to church more often, and we should have gone, and why don't we go? And number three, something like, way down deep, well, I don't care. I'll show God anyway that I'm not going to go. Or something like that. There was no good news in that. And I think as I left, as they thought over what had happened, there was only a feeling of guilt and of inadequacy and maybe some anger. Okay, now that's not the scene that happens now. We do it differently now. We're enlightened. Now we send them out two by two to our prospects. Now who are the prospects? Well, most church's prospect list is made up of what most other people in church call dead wood. These are the inactive people. These are the people who have been vaccinated, in a sense. They have been members of the church and have now fallen out in some way. Or they have never quite joined and they're just on the fringe or something like that. But these inactives now are the target for the evangelism teams, which we have got together by getting volunteers together. And we have a little session about it. We go out two by two, and I wish you could just see what goes on behind the drapes of those houses when the little two-by-two cars come up. You know, a car pulls up in front. You can imagine the scene. George says to Martha, "Martha, somebody's pulling up in front of the house. Do you recognize a car?" They look out through the Venetian blinds. She says, "It's them from the church." "Oh," he says, "it must be October." And they know once again that the evangelism team has been cranked up and they are due for their annual visit. Sure enough, here come two people up the aisle, up the drive. And not a wedding at all. He says to Martha, "You go to the kitchen and get some coffee ready and I'll keep busy in the living room." So I open the door and they say, "Hello, we're from Advent Lutheran Church." And he says, "Yeah, I know, come on in. Just sit down in the living room there." And they'll sit down and then he'll say, "I guess you want to know why we don't come to Advent anymore." "Oh no," they say, "we're here to talk about the church and about the good things that are going on there." "Well, I'll tell you why we don't come to Advent anymore," he'll say. And then will come a tale of confidence betrayed, of pastoral ministry that was inadequate, of egos bruised, or of fight over the color of the carpet, or whatever it was. And these visitors sit there going, "Well, I never heard that before. They did that? Somebody said that to you from our church?" And 20 minutes later, a chastened couple, heads bowed, leave the residence and write on their card, reporting back, "This is something for the pastor to take care of. Recommend the call," and hand it in. Well, again, what's happened? I think sometimes this form of visitation is a kind of put down for those people, because what they see is that they are now being essentially asked, "Why don't you people shape up and be good church members, 100% church members like we are? We, the clean volunteers, the eager folks, we have given freely of our time to come and call on you who are sitting at home reading the paper or watching the ball game. Be like us." And in all humility, that's the message they are getting across. And it must sometimes feel to those folks, again, a put down. It's not good news again. It's simply, "Well, you're not doing your part in the church, and we are. We'd like you to shape up and be as good as we are." Well, my goodness. Is there no way? Am I just being super critical? Well, I simply want to point out that so often evangelism comes across as either I'm doing you a favor in a sort of supercilious way, or please do us a favor and come. And I think neither of these are true to the gospel itself. Let me just give you a couple other substitutes, though, that we often throw in. One is, we say, "Well, I would like to talk about my faith, but I'm really very reticent to talk about Jesus Christ. There are groups that do, but we Lutherans are so reverent about Jesus that we hesitate to use his name in public. We think it's just a little too well, you know, people often swear and use that kind of language, or people buttonhole you on the street, but for us it's difficult to talk about it for him. So we invent substitutes. We don't mind talking about our church. You know, come to our church, we've got a great nursery, we've got a great preacher, we've got swell music, we've got, you know, good building, fine facilities, whatever. We don't mind talking about our church. The trouble is, if we are trying to bring people into the fellowship because we have a good church,
they may also discover that it is a human church and there are people there who are unfriendly. They may not like the music that well, or they may find all kinds of other human things wrong with it. So you're trying to advertise the church. It's kind of like, instead of the Lord of the church, you're kind of falling short. You're stopping short of what you really have to offer and to speak to people about. I recall Helmut Thielicke again. There's a book of his in the bookstore, by the way, called I Believe, which is a book on the Apostles' Creed. It's a book of short essays on the different aspects of the creed. I think it's a really, really fine book. Thielicke recalls in one place where he was walking in Hamburg, in the city where he lives and teaches, and he saw a sign in the window of a store which said, fresh bread for sale. And you know how you get to feel when you think about fresh bread. You get to feel a little hungry. Right away you think, hey, that would be a good idea. So we went into the store and asked for some bread. And the sales lady behind the counter said, we don't sell bread in this store. And he said, well, you have a sign in the window that says fresh bread for sale. And she lit up. She said, oh, no, we don't sell bread, we sell signs. And I sometimes think that we advertise, in a sense, the wrong thing, and we're so interested in the externals, we don't ever get to the bread of life itself, to the reality. So to substitute talking about the church for talking about our Lord is, I think, not fair, not really accurate or adequate. But to talk about Christ or to talk about God in our life, how in the world do you do that? Well, one way some congregations have discovered is to start in a Sunday school class and ask people just to begin to talk a little bit about their spiritual biography. A question like, why are you still a member of the church? What has kept you in the church all these years? Or why have you become a member of the church? And in a group of friends, it's not so hard to say sometimes how you feel and what's happened to you. And the surprising thing is that people who have felt, well, I really don't have much of a story or the evidence that brought me back into the church, the motive, are really pretty weak and pretty shaky, will discover that when they talk with others, that other people will say, hey, that's similar to something that happened to me. And that one gets to find out that, in fact, God is active in other people's lives. And that little touch on yours that you didn't quite know how to interpret is, in fact, characteristic of the way God has been working in many lives. So in that way, you can become at least a little better able to talk about your faith among friends. And then it becomes possible to begin to repeat that tale or that story or whatever you can say of your faith outside the circle of friends to others. And one will say, well, yeah, but that's kind of fragmentary, and it certainly isn't the whole plan of salvation and all that. Well, you don't. That's not your responsibility. I think very often evangelists begin to feel that, you know, it's a kind of test of your faith. You've got to be able to initiate a conversation, deal with all the objections, and get the person into church. Another scalp at your belt, so to speak, another notch in the gun. That's not the way. It is not our job to convert people. It is not our job to convert people. You look in the book of Acts, you discover after Peter's great sermon on Pentecost, it says, and God added daily to the church those who were being saved. And again, if you look through scriptures, Paul says, you know, I plant, Apollos watered, God gives the increase. Think of Johnny Appleseed. Suppose if he believed that it was his responsibility to make sure that every seed he planted grew into an apple tree, how many would he have planted in his lifetime? He would have planted the seed and then camped there for what? How long has it taken an apple tree to get to bear? I don't know, several years? 4 or 5 years, okay. Okay, he might have gotten 10 apple trees planted, huh? Worked down a row of about 10. But he didn't feel it was his responsibility to grow trees. It was his responsibility to plant trees. And there's a fascinating passage in the New Testament that we always, I think, mess up. And that's when these, when the people come back to Jesus, you know, and they've been out preaching. And Jesus tells the story of the soils, the four soils. And we immediately make that into a story of, are you a good soil? Are you a bad soil? No. But the story is to tell the evangelists, the people who have been out preaching the word, what's going to happen with that word. And Jesus is saying, don't worry. You have now planted seed. And in some cases, you're going to find out you get zilch for a result. But in other cases, you're going to discover that people get really turned on for a while. And then they're going to fall away. Okay, he says. And he goes on to say, you know, there's all these different things happen. But you are also going to discover that here and there, that seed falls on good ground. And the yield from that good soil is going to be, he uses 60 and 100-fold. He'd have four kinds of soil. And he says, you're going to get 60-fold out of the good soil alone. So what he's saying is, you see, be of good courage. Don't worry about the results. The results will outweigh the defeats. Only be sure that you planted enough seed so that it can hit all that kind of soil. When you talk to somebody about their faith, you are only one move in God's lifelong chess game with that person. You are only one stage. And you may never see the end of it. But remember, human beings' minds are like tape recorders. And what goes in stays there. It may go down pretty deep, but it's there. I heard two chaplains talking in Germany. They had, they're both in the Air Force, and one had followed the other at a base halfway around the world. And as they sat there talking informally, one said, do you remember the such and such family? Yeah, he said, boy, that was a problem. I felt I really blew. And he said, well, they want you to know, they told me to tell you, that they have now understood what it is to be free in Christ and to be a new creation, and they are active in the congregation and they wanted you to know. Well, how many times do we not have that feedback loop? How fortunate occasionally such a thing can occur, and a chaplain can hear that what he thought was a miserable flop ended up eventually in God's using that work and that life in an effective way. So to be an evangelist, you see, is simply to plant the seed, to say what you can, and to let God take care of the increase. It's kind of like a blind date. You've got to have confidence, not in your ability, but in the attractiveness, in the power of the Lord to whom you are bringing people or to whom you are introducing them. I guess some of you are here old enough to remember the blind date era. I don't know whether it still goes on or not, but I remember very much situations where you wanted to go out, and I'll take the man's side of it simply. It's the one that I have to experience. You want to go out with this girl, and she has a sister named Murgatroyd, or a cousin who is staying with her. And she says, I'd be glad to go out with you if you can get a date for Murgatroyd. Well, you know the feeling. If Murgatroyd now happens to be someone whom you think is going to be difficult to place, let us say, you will go to your friend, Charlie, and say, Charlie, I really have a great opportunity for you. And you will then go into your selling mode. And you will work on Charlie. And you will say, you know, everything from she has a great personality to it takes a while to get to know her, but she's really a barrel of fun when you get to know her. So on and so forth. You do everything you can to make excuses for and to build up and to work this thing out. And I'm sure on the female side, same thing's going on when a date's been arranged. And you have some clodhopper that you have to pawn off on your best friend to get the date to work. But supposing now that Murgatroyd is a real winner. I remember when my roommate would say, well, what's she like? I would say, well, it's kind of hard to say. Just wait. Supremely confident in the fact now that Murgatroyd could win her own victories. I had no need to do the build-up or the selling job. All I had to do was to get the date going. And I knew from then on everybody was going to really have a great time. Well, if you'll pardon the analogy, it seems to me that the Christian ought to have the same kind of confidence in the power of God and His Spirit to be able to simply say, okay, I'll make the introduction, and I think he can take it from there. And it may take him a lifetime. It may go much faster than you would ever believe, but it's always an exciting thing when you discover how God can take the simple words you use and the individual with their difficulties and problems and somehow change them and bring them to a new understanding of His love and His life. So, not only go out with good courage, I think, but speak up with good courage. Not to try to argue somebody into the kingdom of heaven, but just to share with hungry people some of the bread you found. Luther said that was all Christianity was one beggar telling another where to find bread. And that as you do that, the bread of life himself will feed people. And if you're lucky, if you're very lucky, you may hear the results of that encounter. It may take longer than your life, or it may occur in another city far, far after you're off the scene. But God, believe it, God can use that gift you give, that seed you plant, that encounter you make, that word you utter. And that's all you're asked to do. Okay, well, that's about all I wanted to say, and we've got a little time. Maybe you have some reactions to what may have been confusing or partial. May not have gone so far. Yes?
I like the idea of, you know, planting the seed and letting the idea grow and not feeling the compulsion to
clench it.
You know, just really beat it into the ground, so to speak. I heard someone say one time that new Christians, particularly people who've gone through a saving kind of experience, should really be locked in a closet for about 6 to 8 months with some established Christian and work head-to-head with them before they're allowed to go out and try and evangelize. Because so often, they turn off the listeners by the fervor that they bring to that new experience. And once they've sort of mellowed out a little bit, they're much more effective.
Some of us established Christians feel very threatened by those new Christians, too. And we have to ask ourselves, is it they who are being too aggressive, or is it us who are feeling... they are trying to tell me I ought to be different. Maybe they're just so full of their excitement that we do what we say in the scriptures, you rejoice with those who rejoice.
Well, sharing some thoughts with you, I have the privilege of being on the water for 27 years. I work with a lot of longshoremen and loggers and stuff like that. And the thing that amazes me is that you travel in the family of God. When men realize that they're loved right where they're at, and when you sincerely can sit down and not confront their pride, and they can realize that you sincerely care, it really opens up the power of the Spirit to move their lives. Like you said, not argue with them. And I think when we can have the concern to love the unlovable, and when we go to these, quote, church people's homes that haven't been attended, and not try and tell them what they're doing wrong, but to go there and see what we can do to meet their needs, where they're hurting at. Minister to them there. Let them know you love them. I hate to see anybody walk into a home to share the love of God and not sincerely go there because they love them just the way they are. I see so much danger with people running around and not and wanting to be evangelists and not sincerely loving the people the way they are and looking at them through God's eyes. Wives, you hear so much, boy, I wish my husband would come to the Lord. Or guys say, I sure wish my boss would become a Christian. And the motives are because it'd be easier to live with, you'd be easier to get along with, and you'd change your ways. But I feel as if we allow God to motivate us to love them just the way they are, and let them see how much they're loved by God at that point. And going in with God's motivation, not our own, of trying to change your ways, I think we can really see some exciting results too.
That's good news for people to say, you know, somebody cares about it. That's good news. Starting with a human being. I had once heard evangelism described in terms of, I mean, so often it is done this way, in terms of a kind of we-they relationship. They talked about evangelism in terms of high-altitude bombing, which is, you know, you never see the enemy. That's where you broadcast over the radio, or you go stick tracks under doors or something like that. And then there's the ambush, where you advertise a free rock concert or something like that and get people to come, and then you hit them with a gospel or whatever. Infiltration, where you try to act like they are, and talk like they are, and dress like they are, and then one day you say, "Are you a Christian?" And sort of get them from the side, infiltration approach. That always bothered me because and then the final one was, you know, nail the colors to the mast and go down to the ship. You know, stand up and make your testimony. The thing that bothered me about that whole thing was that the underlying image is conflict, is battle. Somebody's going to win and lose. Just the opposite of this concept of going in with love and concern and care. The people who are out there and often are vaccinated against the church. You know, they've been there, they've had a little of it, and they don't like it. So they're immune. It seems to me that those people need sometimes to be seen as in bondage. We have shut-ins who don't come to church. But we care for them because we know that they are physically inhibited from coming. We call them shut-ins. Okay? They have a physical handicap that essentially binds them, or they're bedfast. Good word there, you see. But how about these other people? They're in bondage too. They're in bondage to their pride, for example, because 20 years ago they said, "I'm not going to darken the door of this church again as long as." Well, they're in bondage then to something they themselves have said. Or they're in bondage to a spouse who, in a situation, if they go, they feel that it tears the fabric at home, so they're afraid to go for that reason. Or all the rest. I think it's sometimes helpful if you look at the people you know who are not attending church, not as proud, strong people, but as people who are caught in something. And one of the things to do is to pray that God will free them or liberate them from that usually mental bondage. And one good dissolving agent is caring, communicating that caring, so they can get the courage to drop their pride or their bondage, come loose, get unstuck. Time for one more. Yeah.
I just want to tell you about one lady in our church, sort of in our church, that this whole discussion has, I've been thinking about her ever since we started practically. She runs a dry cleaning and laundromat, and they sold it. The people couldn't handle it. They got the dry cleaners back. The place now has a sign on it that says, "Diane's back. It's warm in here." Mm-hmm. And you walk in, and she's behind the counter, and everyone that goes in there knows that she loves them. She loves every person that comes in. She lets them know it in different ways. She cares about them. And after a while, if they're interested, she tells them why she loves them and why she cares, but not before they're ready. She doesn't have a whole lot of education. She's very intelligent. She's not educated, but she has a marvelous gift of knowing how much to hold back. And I don't think she's brought many people into our church, but she has given very many people a sense of what is good about Christianity. a sense of the love that is possible in a person, given to a person that she has never seen before. I've been in there when people have come in that she hardly knows, has seen once, and they come in, "Oh, Diane, I've decided to have an abortion," or "not to have an abortion," or they just respond back. And I think that she really knows what evangelism is about.
Okay. Thank you, Maria. I'm reminded of a session this morning about the Holy Spirit calling, gathering, enlightening, and sanctifying. And I think some people may be God's instruments to call. There are other people then that are God's instruments in gathering and enlightening. God uses sometimes many people, and there are often those folks who are out there on the sort of front edge who start that process going and get people sensitive to the fact there is love and care in Christ. And in time, other people can build on that work and give their own gifts, add their gifts to what she's giving and doing.